and you're listening to
CFIC,
the best radio station we've ever heard.
From New York, this is Democracy Now.
국회의 계엄 해제 요구가 있어.
After the National Assembly's demand to lift martial law troops have been withdrawn. I will accept the National Assembly's demand and lift martial law through a cabinet meeting.
Chaos in Korea. South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol is facing calls to resign or be impeached after he shocked the nation by imposing martial law. Faced with overwhelming opposition, the president reversed the decision 6 hours later. We'll get the latest. Then, is that a spy in your pocket? We'll speak to Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Ronan Farrow about Surveilled, his new documentary looking at how surveillance spyware targeting cell phones is threatening democracy across the globe.
Surveillance of journalists, and you know, this goes for surveillance of dissidents, it goes for surveillance of political opposition members that we see in the film and in the world now so often, is not just information gathering. Surveillance of this type is intimidation. And it shrinks the space for all kinds of expression in democracies.
We'll speak to Ronan Farrow and the director of Surveilled, Matthew O'Neill. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Members of South Korea's opposition have moved to impeach President Yoon Suk-yeol after he plunged South Korea into chaos by declaring martial law in a surprise broadcast late Tuesday night. Shortly after the announcement, live television footage showed heavily armed South Korean troops attempting to enter the National Assembly building, where parliamentary aides were seen trying to hold the soldiers back with furniture and fire extinguishers. The extraordinary scene played out as South Korean lawmakers gathered inside to vote down the martial law order and declare it invalid. This is Speaker of National Assembly Woo Won-sik.
국민 여러분께서는 안심하시기 바랍니다.
Everyone, please be assured. The National Assembly will defend democracy together with the people. For the soldiers and police who are currently in the National Assembly, please leave this place immediately.
As details emerge that the order would ban all political activities, protests, and labor strikes, the Korean Confederation of Trade Unions announced an indefinite general strike and called on the president to resign. Meanwhile, thousands of people gathered outside the National Assembly protesting the president's order. Amidst widespread and growing opposition, President Yoon backed down and revoked his order 6 hours later. His entire cabinet then offered their resignations, though President Yoon ordered them to, quote, fulfill your duties even after this moment, unquote. After headlines, we'll go to Seoul, South Korea for the latest. In Gaza, at least 5 people, including 4 children, were killed today in an Israeli drone strike on a food distribution center and a house in the Nuseirat refugee camp. Elsewhere, at least 2 people were killed when Israel bombed residential buildings in Deir al-Balah, where others remain missing under the rubble. In the Berej refugee camp, Israeli warplanes struck a UN-run school sheltering displaced Palestinians, setting more than a dozen tents ablaze and killing a Palestinian medic. Meanwhile, in Beit Lahia, 3 medical workers were wounded Tuesday, one of them critically, when Israel bombed the Kamel Adwan Hospital. The hospital's director reported quadcopter drones were seen dropping bombs packed with shrapnel. It was Israel's 5th attack on the hospital in recent weeks. In Khan Yunis, a massive line formed Tuesday as Palestinians queued for rations of flour at a UN-run food distribution center. Many of them described long and fruitless days searching for bread and other staples amidst Israel's stifling blockade.
This bag of flour we received won't last a month, not even with careful rationing. We appeal to the United Nations, UNRWA, UNICEF, and all international organizations working to support displaced people or Palestinian refugees to preserve our cause, to help us, to do everything they can and dedicate all their efforts to help the displaced in Gaza because our situation is so difficult.
In Ottawa, Canada, over 100 Jewish peace activists staged a sit-in protest Tuesday inside a parliamentary building demanding Canada stop arming Israel. At least 14 protesters were arrested and issued trespass notices. The Jews Say No to Genocide Coalition is demanding Canada cancel all active military export permits to Israel and close loopholes allowing weapons to reach Israel via the United States without requiring permits. They're also calling on Canada to halt purchases of Israeli military hardware. To see our interview with one of the protesters as the sit-in was taking place, go to democracynow.org. Syria's state news agency reports Syrian troops backed by Syrian and Russian warplanes are fighting fierce battles in the central Hama province as rebels seek to build on their surprise takeover of Aleppo last week. The Syrian Observatory for Human Rights reports the rebels had captured several settlements just outside Hama City and have begun shelling some neighborhoods. Meanwhile, the Pentagon said Tuesday the United States carried out strikes in eastern Syria in response to a rocket launch near a base housing U.S. troops. The Pentagon did not say who was responsible for the rocket attacks or who it had fired on. Elsewhere, Israel carried out an airstrike on a car near Syria's capital, Damascus, Tuesday. A Lebanese security source told Reuters the attack killed a senior Hezbollah figure responsible for liaising with the Syrian army. President-elect Trump's transition team has belatedly signed an agreement to allow the FBI to conduct background checks on Trump's picks to serve in his new administration. Trump had allowed weeks to pass without signing the agreement. The news site Semaphore reports some of Trump's cabinet nominees remain opposed to submitting themselves to an FBI check until the bureau's revamped by a director chosen by Trump. The Trump transition team is reportedly still looking into tapping into the private sector rather than the FBI to conduct background checks on some of Trump's nominees. This comes as the Wall Street Journal reports Trump is considering replacing current Pentagon nominee Pete Hegseth with Florida Governor Ron DeSantis amidst reports that Hegseth sexually harassed women and misused funds at two veterans organizations. The New Yorker magazine also reported he once shouted, kill all Muslims, while publicly drunk. On Tuesday, NBC News reported that on more than a dozen occasions during Hegseth's time as a co-host of Fox and Friends Weekend, colleagues smelled alcohol on his breath before he went on the air. Prior to entering politics, Ron DeSantis served in the Navy as an attorney, first at Guantanamo Bay Prison in Cuba and later in Iraq. Former Guantanamo prisoners say DeSantis personally witnessed them being force-fed and tortured. To see our interview with one of those former prisoners, Mansour Adaifi, go to democracynow.org. Meanwhile, Trump has offered the Pentagon's number two job of Deputy Defense Secretary to billionaire private equity investor Steven Feinberg. Feinberg is CEO of Cerberus Capital Management, which heavily invests in the weapons industry. He's been a major donor to Trump's campaigns, including a nearly $1 million gift to a pro-Trump super PAC in 2016. On Tuesday, Trump's pick to lead the Drug Enforcement Agency withdrew his nomination. Florida Sheriff Chad Chronister had come under fire from Trump supporters who objected to his enforcement of COVID regulations during the pandemic, including the arrest of a Florida pastor who held a church service in violation of lockdown rules. In California, the former Democratic state lawmaker Adam Gray has defeated Republican Congressmember John Duarte to win the last outstanding House race of the 2024 election. Gray's victory flips another House seat for Democrats, giving them 215 seats to Republicans 220 when the new Congress is sworn in on January 3rd. The slim Republican majority could become even more narrow after President-elect Trump tapped two Republican Congress members to serve in his administration and after Florida Representative Matt Gaetz resigned from Congress, putting an end to a House Ethics Committee probe over allegations Gaetz was involved in the sex trafficking of an underage girl. There's still a push in Congress to release the report on that ethics probe. In Sacramento, California, lawmakers have begun a special legislative session to shield the state from potential federal interference by the incoming Trump administration. Democrats who hold the majority are seeking to Trump-proof laws, including those guaranteeing reproductive freedoms and protecting undocumented immigrants. Robert Rivas is Speaker of the California State Assembly.
If LGBTQ people come under attack, if hardworking immigrants are targeted, if women's reproductive freedom is threatened, we will fight back with everything we have.
In a blow to reproductive rights, a federal appeals court has ruled that Iowa can enforce its abortion travel ban, blocking people who need an abortion from seeking the procedure in other states where abortion is legal. The law makes so-called abortion trafficking a crime punishable by up to 5 years in prison and prohibits Idaho residents from transporting a minor who needs an abortion across state lines where the procedure is legal, such as Idaho's neighboring states of Oregon, Washington, and Montana. The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals only struck down a portion of the law, which would have prohibited providers from talking to pregnant teens about their reproductive health care options, saying it violated First Amendment rights. In related news, Arizona providers will be allowed to perform abortions past 15 weeks of pregnancy while a new lawsuit seeking to overturn the state's abortion ban plays out in court. The suit was filed by reproductive care advocates who argue the ban is now unconstitutional after Arizona voters earlier this month overwhelmingly approved a ballot measure enshrining abortion rights in the state's constitution. President Biden met with his Angolan counterpart, President João Lourenço, in the capital Luanda on Tuesday, becoming the first U.S. president to visit Angola, a former Portuguese colony. Biden used the trip to promote the Lobito Corridor, a U.S.-funded multi-billion dollar rail and port infrastructure project connecting Angola to Central Africa as multinational corporations seek to access the region's vast mineral resources. Biden delivered a speech after touring Angola's National Museum of Slavery, built on the site of a 17th century Portuguese chapel where enslaved people were forcibly baptized before being forced into the Middle Passage.
We remember the stolen men and women and children who were brought to our shores in chains, subjected to unimaginable cruelty. The United States founded an idea, one embedded in our Declaration of Independence, that is that all men and women are created equal and deserve to be treated equally throughout their lives. It's abundantly clear today we have not lived up to that idea.
Voters in Namibia have elected their nation's first woman president. On Tuesday, Namibia's Electoral Commission reported Netumbo Nandi-Ndaitwah of the governing Southwest Africa's People's Organization, or SWAPO, had won the first round of voting outright with 57% of the vote. Opposition politicians contested the result, claiming a deeply flawed electoral process and promised a legal challenge. In Afghanistan, the Taliban government is drawing renewed outrage after it banned Afghan women from receiving midwifery and nursing educational training. This was one of the last remaining options for Afghan women and girls to further their studies under Taliban rule, which prohibits them from obtaining secondary and higher education. Human rights groups warn the new decree halting the training of new female healthcare workers will also impede access to medical care, as male providers are not allowed to treat women and girls unless there's a male guardian present. And Tuesday marked the 40th anniversary of one of the worst industrial disasters of the 20th century. Shortly after midnight, December 3rd, 1984, in the city of Bhopal, India, tons of lethal gases leaked from a pesticide factory run by the U.S. company Union Carbide. Between 8,000 and 10,000 people died within days. Thousands more died in the following years. While survivors, their children and grandchildren are still suffering from chronic health issues due to the leak and the toxic waste that was left behind by Union Carbide, which was later purchased by the U.S. multinational Dow Chemical. Survivors and their advocates took to the streets of Bhopal yesterday as they continue to fight for justice 40 years later.
Today, 40 years later, we are asking pretty much the same things as people were asking 40 years ago. People of Bhopal are seeking that there be a special medical commission on Bhopal be set up so that there is appropriate free and health care for gas victims and their children who continue to bear the scars of the Union Carbide disaster even today. We are asking that the toxic global toxic hotspot that emerges in this middle of the city be cleaned up by Union Carbide and Dow Chemical.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. When we come back, chaos in Korea. South Korea's president faces calls to resign or be impeached after he declared martial law for 6 hours. Stay with us. The Beloved, in an official anthem of social movements in South Korea. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now!'s Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
Members of South Korea's opposition have moved to impeach President Yoon Suk-yeol after he plunged South Korea into crisis by declaring martial law in a surprise late-night broadcast on Tuesday.
저는 북한 공산 세력의 위협으로부터
I declare martial law to protect the Free Republic of Korea from the threat of North Korean communist forces, to eradicate the despicable pro-North Korean anti-state forces that are plundering the freedom and happiness of our people, and to protect the free constitutional order.
Minutes later, the leader of the opposition called on supporters and members of the opposition to gather at the National Assembly. Nearly 300 troops stormed the National Assembly as lawmakers gathered inside to vote down the martial law order and declare it invalid. It passed unanimously. This is Representative Kim Min-suk, a senior member of the Democratic Party of Korea.
On December 3rd, 2024, at 10:27 p.m., President Yoon Suk-yeol declared martial law. This declaration is illegal and constitutes a criminal act directly violating the Constitution and other laws. It is essentially a coup d'etat.
As details emerge that the order would ban all political activities, protests, and labor strikes, several close aides to the president resigned, and his own party urged him to repeal his declaration. The Korean Confederation of Trade Unions announced an indefinite general strike, called on the president to resign. Meanwhile, thousands of people gathered outside the National Assembly protesting the president's order. Amidst widespread and growing opposition, President Yoon backed down and revoked his order 6 hours later.
국회의 계엄 해제 요구가 있어 계엄
After the National Assembly's demand to lift martial law troops have been withdrawn. I will accept the National Assembly's demand and lift martial law through a cabinet meeting.
For more on these dramatic developments, we're joined by two guests. Christine Ahn is international coordinator of the campaign Korea Peace Now. She's also founder and executive director of Women Cross DMZ, a global movement of women mobilizing to end the Korean War. She's joining us from Honolulu, Hawaii. And from Seoul, South Korea, we're joined by organizer Dae Han-sung. He is head of the networking team of the International Strategy Center. He's part of the No Cold War Collective. We're going to begin with you, Dae Han-sung. You're there in Seoul. Can you explain what happened near midnight on Tuesday night?
Sure. Around around 10:30 p.m., basically, we started, like, I was at a funeral myself and with various organizers and activists. And at 10:30 p.m., I just saw that there was just a lot of social media that, in effect, was saying that martial law had been called. And of course, all of us at the beginning were completely incredulous. Like, we would never imagine, some of us, the younger ones, that we would have martial law called during our lifetimes. And afterwards, a lot of the people went to the National Assembly themselves. So a lot of them went home, and after going home, they went directly to the National Assembly to gather and to protect the National Assembly from the military troops that were being dispatched. So it martial law was called at 10:30 p.m. And basically between 11 and 12, thousands of people had gathered in front of the National Assembly. I myself was not there, but I was in constant communication with people. And I was just doing a lot of the writing, a lot of the social media to just be able to provide support in the social media and to let people know what was happening. And I think what's extraordinary is that a lot of ordinary people came out. I think I've heard that people were saying that there were delivery people that just stopped working. And when they heard the news, they just like rushed to the National Assembly. There were people that were at home just relaxing, and then they rushed. And a lot of the people, when they gathered, they were able to block and prevent the armored trucks from entering the grounds of the National Assembly. A lot of them were chanting to abolish the martial law and to, basically abolish martial law and to down with the dictatorship. And a lot of this was happening while the deliberation was happening inside the National Assembly. And so, yeah, in many regards, I think the National Assembly members, the 190 that showed up, were the ones that revoked the martial law. But of course, it was a lot of the energy and a lot of the effort and a lot of the presence of people that had rushed to the National Assembly that really made a huge difference in turning this thing around.
And Dae Han Sung, was there any indication beforehand that this was about to occur? I know that the president was having trouble passing a budget because the legislature is controlled by the National Assembly is controlled by the opposition party. But was there any indication beforehand that he was about to do this?
No, I mean, I think like nobody knew. I think even his cabinet, or apparently a lot of his cabinet, did not know what was going to happen, that he was going to declare martial law. I think in many regards, if one were to try to kind of like understand what was going on through Yoon's mind, I think perhaps the things that would shed a little bit of a light into like what is his motivation, why is he doing this at this time, does have to do with not being able to pass the national budget that he desired. The Democratic Party that has like nearly two, that has basically a majority in the National Assembly, they were cutting a lot of his discretionary spending or discretionary budget for the prosecutor's office, for the presidential office, for the audit office. And basically they were planning on pushing this through on December 10th. And of course, they would be able to do this because they had the majority seats. I mean, other things that have been kind of constantly in the news is basically just the First Lady, accusations of bribery and stock manipulation. There were very different developments that were happening that would have revealed a lot of the details of his wife's bribery and stock manipulation. And also, it's important to note that Yoon's support ratings are very low. They're at 19%. And basically, his low support ratings are also dragging down his own political party. So his own conservative political party is feeling the pressure to also do something about the different allegations of corruption and stock manipulation that are surrounding the First Lady. And so I think there was also this belief that on the part of Yoon that eventually the Conservative Party would also join together with the Democratic Party and basically overturn a veto. Like Yoon has been, Yoon has done a record number of vetoes, 24. And basically a lot of these vetoes are against laws that are trying to create a special investigation on his wife. And basically because she, yes.
Yeah, no, I'd like to just bring in Christine Ahn to the conversation, international coordinator of the campaign Korea Peace Now. Christine, welcome to Democracy Now! I wanted to ask you if you could talk a little bit about who President Yoon is, especially his relationship to the U.S. government. And also, this is not the first time South Korea has faced martial law. Wondering if you could remind our viewers and listeners about the martial law back in 1980 that led to the famous Gwangjung uprising and the massacre of hundreds, possibly thousands, of South Koreans.
Yes, thanks, Juan. President Yoon Suk-yeol is a former prosecutor. He actually rose in prominence by investigating the former right-wing conservative president Park Geun-hye, who was ultimately impeached because of a very similar situation where hundreds of thousands, millions actually, of South Koreans took to the streets in 2016 and 2017 to demand that she be impeached. And so he played a role in convicting, and ultimately she spent time in prison. So that's his background. He has come into power. He was narrowly elected. I think it was 0.8% by less than a percent in May 2022. And since he entered office, he has just been embroiled in scandal after scandal, a lot of it affiliated with his wife, but just gross negligence and incompetence in his ability to govern. So I think that that has been very much undergirding South Koreans' outrage over this president. He has also, led South Korea in really historic democratic backsliding, going after journalists. He's gutted the Ministry of Gender Equality, targeted labor. The list just goes on and on. I mean, even doctors and medical students have been on strike for over half the year. And because of dramatic cuts in the medical, the health system in South Korea, which is famously known around the world. So because of his gross negligence and incompetence, I think that is what fomented so much of the frustration and anger. But going back to the last declaration of martial law by Chun Doo-hwan, which was actually backed and known by the U.S. Carter at the time had sent paramilitary troops, not American but South Korean, from the DMZ to go and quash the uprising as citizens and students and farmers and workers rose up in protest of martial law and the dictatorship. And I think that experience, even though it was 44 years ago, it's still very much in the minds of the Korean people. And so when they heard that martial law was declared, my friend Yoo Kyung-ko, who is a seasoned anti-war activist in South Korea, said that, you know, her SMS was blowing up, that just people were saying, we have to go, we have to take to the streets, we have to protest, we cannot allow a return because of the horrific experience that South Koreans endured under dictatorship, the beatings, the torture. I mean, Kap Sol, a Korean-American journalist that many of your listeners probably read his work on, Jacobin, you know, he is still suffering a twitch in his neck because of he was beaten by a club and his skull was almost fractured. So that kind of still the memory, the living memory, the emotional, the psychological trauma of that period, South Koreans just will not stand that. They will not tolerate that. And so I think in many ways, the what we witnessed in the last day in the 24-hour period is extraordinary. It's an extraordinary example of what Americans must learn from South Korea about how people, ordinary people, it's not governments or the military that will secure a democracy. It will be people and people power. And I think we have to take the lessons and learn from Daehan and other South Koreans that have been organizing under an authoritarian leading government for the last several years. So as we prepare in 2025, and I just have to add, I mean, what we witnessed in that 6-hour period of a strong man declaring martial law and the reaction by the people and the other elected officials, including members of his own party, going and protesting and vetoing that martial law order. Imagine what would have happened on January 6th if the American people actually went as the MAGA people were rioting and raiding our halls of Congress. And if members of Congress and the people actually showed up and refuted and condemned this action, what difference that would have made and the difference that 2025 would be for this country and for the world.
Christine, we only have a minute. You're director of Women Across the DMZ. You're international coordinator of Korea Peace Now. And just a few weeks ago, you were banned from entering South Korea. If you can explain what happened and also the president's reason for martial law when he said he wants to protect the Free Republic of Korea from the threat of North Korean communist forces and that the despicable pro-North Korean anti-state forces are plundering the freedom and happiness of our people. Explain what that means.
Thanks, Amy. Yeah, 3 weeks ago, I was about to board a plane here in Honolulu to Incheon to deliver a keynote speech at an international youth peace summit. It was actually hosted by the Gyeonggi province, the government that borders the DMZ. And I was told that I could not board the plane. And, you know, sadly, this was not my first rodeo. In 2017, I was similarly trying to board a plane to go to Korea and was informed that I had been placed on the blacklist that 10,000 South Koreans had been put on by the former right-wing president, Park Geun-hye. But fortunately, at that time, Moon Jae-in had just been elected after the Candlelight Revolution. And so I was able to they transformed it in 72 hours, and I was able to enter the country. Now, the kind of the allegation or the justification that Yoon uses is it's frankly just pathetic. And I'm just so glad that South Koreans have evolved, and they it's a McCarthyist playbook to, you know, use the threat of a North Korean invasion to justify quashing dissent, any kind of dissent. This is a tried and true trope that right-wing leaders have used. And unfortunately, who it hurts the most is South Korean democracy.
Christine, we're going to have to leave it there, but we're going to continue to follow what develops as the people of South Korea call for the ouster or impeachment of the Korean president who declared martial law for 6 hours yesterday. Christine Ahn, international coordinator of the campaign Korea Peace Now, also founder and executive director of Women Cross DMZ. I also want to thank our guest, Daehan Song, head of the networking team in the International Strategy Center, part of the No Cold War Collective, speaking to us from Seoul. Coming up, is that a spy in your pocket? We'll speak to Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Ronan Farrow about his new film, Surveilled. Stay with us. ago by Yiruma. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We turn now to a film that looks at the increasing use of spyware targeting journalists, human rights advocates, dissidents across Western democracies and around the world. The HBO original documentary Surveilled, which is airing tonight on HBO at 9 p.m., follows Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Ronan Farrow, who uncovers how Pegasus and other surveillance programs are threatening democracy across the globe. This is the film's trailer.
Why should people around the world care about the hacking that you're documenting here?
These cases affect 450 million people. It's a violation of their rights.
What we ended up finding was actually the tip of the iceberg.
Spyware is this powerful surveillance tool. Big spyware companies say they sell this tech only to governments. But this multi-billion dollar industry is mostly unregulated. The most advanced spyware can turn your smartphone into a spy in your pocket. It can copy everything and record you without you ever knowing, and then just disappear without a trace. This company, NSO Group, makes Pegasus, advanced spyware reportedly deployed in at least 45 countries. With allegations, it's being used to target journalists, human rights activists, and political dissidents. What's the most objectionable thing that you saw in your time at the company?
One of the moral problems that I had was a journalist murder.
Should people be concerned?
Definitely, yes.
Does NSO know that some of its customers are abusing this technology?
This tool could fall into the hands of the Iranians, the North Koreans, the Chinese. We need our experts to know what is out there.
They targeted my family. My mom, she worked at the hospitals, so they had access to hundreds of data of patients all around the world.
Do you think it's headed down a path of more domestic impact?
These technologies, any nefarious use that we can imagine, we're probably going to see.
The trailer to the new HBO original film Surveilled, now streaming on Max, the film directed by Perry Peltz and Matthew O'Neill. On Tuesday, Democracy Now!'s Juan Gonzalez and I spoke with Matt O'Neill and Ronan Farrow, who produced the film. Ronan is a contributing writer at The New Yorker. His latest article headlined "The Technology the Trump Administration Could Use to Hack Your Phone." I began by reading to Ronan from a recent article in The Guardian that notes, in 2017, while reporting on a story on Harvey Weinstein that would, along with a New York Times report, kick off the Me Too movement, the investigative journalist Ronan Farrow found himself the target of covert surveillance. The efforts to suppress investigations into Weinstein's history of sexual abuse, for which the Hollywood mogul paid the Israeli private intelligence firm Black Cube, were mostly old school, unquote. I asked Ronan Farrow to lay out what happened.
Well, I got a firsthand view of the toolkit that powerful institutions and individuals can deploy when they're trying to suppress reporting. And I saw it on a miniature scale where one mogul did this, frankly, insane maneuver of retaining a private intelligence company that literally hired actors, former military and intelligence people from Israel, to play roles and insinuate themselves into individuals' lives who are around the story. That included sources that I was working with, women who, as it turns out, had allegations of assault against Weinstein. It included journalists working on the story, including me. And so there was a two-pronged approach. There were people posing as people who wanted to talk to us, wanted to get close to us. And then there were also subcontractors who were hired to just do the traditional gumshoe work of staking people like me out. I had two guys outside of my apartment. And eventually I was able to get the contracts and all the signatures of the lawyers and prove that this operation was happening and get sources inside this company, Black Cube, to describe what they were doing. And actually one of the subcontractors that was following me around all the time, sometimes using some high-tech approaches too, pinging my phone, getting my geolocation data so they could follow me to meetings. One of them became a source in the end. So I wrote a book about this, Catch and Kill, and there's a documentary series on that if people are interested in more. But I did, through that experience, through this relatively low-tech approach to surveillance, get a little picture of how personally devastating it can be to have your private interactions monitored in that way, in this case, there were real stakes, because I was talking to whistleblowers around this story who were risking everything and couldn't be uncovered if I wanted the story to go forward. And I also saw how unsafe it makes you feel. Surveillance of journalists, and, you know, this goes for surveillance of dissidents, it goes for surveillance of political opposition members that we see in the film and in the world now so often, is not just information gathering. Surveillance of this type is intimidation, and it shrinks the space for all kinds of expression in democracies.
Yeah, Ronan, from that that relatively low-tech type of surveillance to what we're confronting today and in recent years, how did then you decide to cover this aspect of the high-tech surveillance?
Well, through that reporting, I developed sources in the Israeli private intelligence world, and I spent some time in Tel Aviv. I spent some years getting close to people in this industry, in this world, and I clocked through my own experiences just how pivotal a challenge this is for anyone who cares about maintaining people's basic rights and maintaining the free flow of information in democracies in order to protect those rights. Surveillance, I realized, was a linchpin. It wasn't some sidebar issue. It was one of the tools that people use to try to suppress democracy, to suppress the free flow of information. It is part of the authoritarian playbook that we see historically again and again, that police states emerge where there are oversteps into privacy violations. And I realized as I was looking at this issue and experiencing these dynamics as a journalist myself, that the bleeding edge of this kind of surveillance, and the thing that was transforming it and making it more available and more intrusive and scarier, was this modern spyware that can take control of phones at a time when we're more and more enmeshed with our phones. And I realized that this was one of the foremost challenges confronting journalists around the world, and also one of the challenges that anyone, even if you don't think of yourself as being in a vulnerable category, you're not an activist, you're not a dissident, you should care about and should understand, because phones are increasingly not private spaces. I dealt with, in addition to being followed around, dynamics where personal information was leaked around stories. I worked on stories about Trump's collaboration with the National Enquirer that ultimately helped catalyze that indictment around Trump and hush payments. And during that reporting, I also had, you know, intimate texts leaked. There were all sorts of efforts to use private information as a lever. So I was just seeing how again and again, if you want to expose the truth, if you want to be a voice of opposition to power, you're inevitably dealing with this kind of surveillance. And I was seeing how the highest tech version of it was the scariest, was the most secretive, was the most poorly understood.
So tell us about Pegasus, and this amazing film, Surveilled, takes us to Israel, takes us to your investigation of the company and who the company is selling to.
So the biggest players in the spyware market, which is now a multi-billion dollar industry, and it mostly is comprised of companies that want to stay secretive. So there's not a lot of reporting on this. There's not a ton of public-facing websites. Companies that do have a kind of public-facing presence, they don't actually talk about what they do or who their clients are. This is one reason why the reporting was necessary. Now, in this multi-billion dollar industry, the big players claim, in a bid for legitimacy, that they only sell to government offices, mostly government intelligence agencies, government defense offices. But the technology that's privately available for purchase by those offices is now cheaper, more efficient, more intrusive. So what you're seeing is two categories of change. You're seeing governments that previously didn't have the size and the resources to have a CIA-style high-tech surveillance operation just buy a kind of CIA in a box. We talk in the film to officials in small Western democracies who love this technology. And by the way, I should point out, small Western democracies where the populations of those countries don't yet know that this technology is being used against them. And, you know, we hear from those officials how they think it's great that they can ostensibly, in some of these cases with warrants, but much more freely and cheaply just hack into people's phones as needed in law enforcement operations. There are legitimate arguments for the use of this technology, like with any surveillance technology. And theoretically, in those Western democracies where there is a process to get a warrant, this is something that shouldn't have to be scary. But what we see over and over again is that it just gets abused. I would argue inevitably. Surveillance technology has historically always been abused. Now the technology is more advanced and more frightening than ever and more available than ever. So abuse is more possible and more ready than ever. What we've seen in the last few years is not only that repressive regimes with a poor human rights record are using this technology against journalists and against dissidents, against political opposition members, and sometimes, by the way, with dangerous and even deadly results. There have been studies that have linked hundreds of cases of violence to spyware technology. A lot of the players involved, including NSO Group, deny this, but NSO Group's flagship technology, Pegasus, was allegedly found on the phone of at least one associate close to Jamal Khashoggi in the time frame when he was murdered by the Saudi regime. We see this over and over again. Javier Valdez in Mexico, a great reporter who was working on cartel stories, was killed. People around him had Pegasus on their phones. So that's the pattern under repressive regimes. But we're seeing not only that, but also one Western democracy with an ostensible commitment to human rights after another see scandals in which this technology is purchased and then overused. We've seen it in Greece. We've seen it in Poland, where just this week, a former spy chief in that country was actually arrested as part of inquiries into a massive spyware dragnet that happened under the previous administration there. And we've seen it in Spain, where some of this film is set and where we helped document this massive cluster of hacks where the Spanish government, which you wouldn't think would be a player that would be responsible for this kind of a breach, they just hacked one civil society member after another associated with a separatist movement, but peaceful one in Catalonia.
And Matthew O'Neill, you're the director of the film, and specifically the focus of the film on Spain and the independence movement in Catalonia. What most surprised you in doing that work in Spain?
Well, I think when Perry Pelt and I first sat down with Ronan, and Perry's the other director of the film, when he started talking about the way his reporting was leading to Spain, we had heard of Pegasus. We think it's a really important subject, this cyber espionage. We associated with autocracies, Saudi Arabia, imagine the capabilities of a Russia or a China, but that this was happening in Spain and that Ronan was sitting on the cusp of exposing what at that point was the largest cluster of Pegasus infections inside any one place in one group. I think it started with 67. Now it's in the hundreds. Our eyes were opened because it felt like this story, what was unfolding in a democracy, in a U.S. ally, was something that people needed to know about. And our idea, as we talked about how to tell this story, because Ronan's reporting was already so extensive, was what could we do to give the audience access to Ronan's process and see the reporting and the discoveries unfold. And that's part of what makes Surveilled, I think, really interesting. Perry and I have been longtime admirers of Ronan as a journalist and a reporter, and this gave not only us, but all of you at home, the opportunity to ride along shotgun with him.
So this is a clip from the HBO documentary Surveilled, in which our guest, Ronan Farrow, speaks with the Citizen Lab's Elias Campo in Catalonia.
Why should people around the world care about the hacking that you're documenting here in Catalonia?
So this is going to be one of the first cases where there's such a large and vast number of affected people, and from a vast and different type of categories of society. So we've had the Parliament of Catalonia targeted, we've had the government of Catalonia targeted, we've had lawyers targeted, we've had civil leaders of cultural organizations of Catalonia targeted.
This is not some future Orwellian scenario. It happened here. It's happening here.
It's happening here.
And this is another clip of the HBO documentary Surveilled, featuring Jordi Soleil, a Catalan politician, former member of the European Parliament.
The iPhone will generate a diagnostic file which won't include personal data. We just received confirmation that your phone was hacked twice, one on the 11th of June and then again on the 27th of June.
2020?
When does it look like you were infected?
I have to check the date, but around that day, I was appointed member of the European Parliament.
How do you feel knowing that you may have been compromised in this way?
Well, I feel surprised and angry at the same time.
So that's the Catalan politician, former member of the European Parliament, Jordi Soleil. And before that, Elias Campo, who is the investigator, he lives in Barcelona. His sister and parents were also, their phones were infected with Pegasus. Ronan Farrow, if you can talk about the significance of this, and it goes to the whole issue of you've got a spy in your pocket. Exactly what are the authorities, those who are paying for this, the information they're getting from your phone?
Well, everything, potentially. People have to start realizing that their phones are now public spaces in so many ways. Even if you're just a person using your phone in a run-of-the-mill way and you don't think you're in one of these vulnerable categories, anyone with the resources can hack your phone if they want to. Any country, even places where there are supposed protections of privacy rights, are now battlegrounds over this technology, where we are seeing people like the sister and parents of Elias Campo, who you mentioned, who are apolitical, getting caught up in surveillance dragnets. I've been, in my ongoing reporting in recent weeks, talking to privacy law experts who really stress at this point that one should know about this and care about this and exercise good digital hygiene and get the protections that you can, maybe even get your phone tested, whether you are, again, in a vulnerable category or not. And so in this case in Spain, you saw people like Elias's parents, who are just doctors, have all of their patients' sensitive records and photos and scans divulged to whoever wants to use them. All they know is the government now potentially has all of this information.
And the phone becomes a microphone?
Pegasus and other similar competing technologies can turn on your microphone without you knowing, can turn on your camera and record video without you knowing, and send all of that information back to whoever has purchased and is working with NSO or whatever the spyware company is to operate the technology.
And Ronan, what if a person did want to disinfect their phone if they suspected that they were being surveilled? Is there a new industry arising now to basically check phones? And are we seeing sort of an arms race between the surveillance folks and the anti-surveillance folks in terms of these smartphones that almost virtually everyone has in their pocket?
Well, when I talk about the world now being a battlefield over this technology, one of the fights, one of the fronts in that battle is between the technology companies, the platform holders that operate your operating system on your phone, like Apple, that operate your messaging applications like WhatsApp, and on the other side of the battlefield, the spyware companies. So in the film and in my print reporting, I talked to both the programmers at, for instance, WhatsApp, who every day, there's a team within that company, within Meta now owns it, looking at what are the attempts to intrude on this technology? What are these, at times, astonishingly creative technical solutions that allow this technology to worm its way into your phone through little vulnerabilities in the code? And then I also talked to the programmers at, for instance, NSO Group, who are really proud of that daily fight where they find creative solutions to get into the phones, and who have to exercise a lot of rationalization frankly, is my view, in the face of all this evidence that those efforts are being misused and abused to target vulnerable people.
So in the film Surveilled, you interview a whistleblower, right, at NSO. Ronan Farrow interviews an NSO whistleblower who's asked for anonymity.
So you're hacking these phones. What kinds of reactions did you get?
It's jaw-dropping. It's very impressive for the first time that you've seen.
What was the pitch that you were offering these governments?
Usually we have like one iPhone, one Android device. We used to demonstrate how we can exfiltrate the data from those devices, actively take snapshots of the screen or pictures from the camera, actively record through the microphones.
What should the average citizen in any country in the world know about this company and this technology?
It's very powerful. It's very intrusive.
Should people be concerned?
Yeah.
We're telling these governments how to exfiltrate the data, he says, and his voice is disguised as you talk to him, an NSO group whistleblower, and they make Pegasus. So if you can talk about the U.S. buying this technology from Trump to Biden.
Under multiple administrations of both parties, we have seen overreaches of surveillance technology. Under the first Trump administration, the New York Times has reported extensively on this, there was actually a purchase of this very technology, Pegasus, which again can seize control of a phone, turn it into a listening device, disgorge all of your private data, by the FBI. So the FBI purchased, later Christopher Wray, the FBI director, told Congress, just for testing purposes, a Pegasus account. They did it through a subcontractor. Later, the New York Times sued for more information that showed pretty clearly that this was not clearly delineated just for testing purposes. There was a whole conversation within the FBI where they wanted to deploy this potentially on American soil in an operational, very real way. Now, as far as we know, that didn't happen. That stopped. And under the Biden administration, there have been halting efforts, at least of a limited quality, to curtail the use of this technology. There's often dissensus and tension across the government on this. I know of cases that have not yet been made public where Department of Justice offices, where Department of Defense offices have purchased foreign private spyware technology to help in their efforts, because not all of these offices have the resources of the CIA. Now, the Biden administration, in response to my reporting calls, did announce, and we disclosed this for the first time publicly in one of my New Yorker stories, an executive order where they essentially said foreign spyware that has a record of being abused shouldn't be purchased by the U.S. government. But the standards for what meets that criterion are really amorphous. And what we've seen since then is that the U.S. government has gone right on purchasing more spyware. Just this past fall, we saw the Department of Homeland Security, and there's been reporting that this is specifically ICE, the immigration office under the Department of Homeland Security, purchase another really powerful Israeli spyware technology called, it's a company called Paragon, and the technology is called Graphite. And, you know, I have sources within that company. They do bill themselves as a more ethically clean alternative. And one of the things that they promised the U.S. government in the vetting process that led up to this multi-million dollar contract was that they would put restraints on how other clients, other foreign governments that use their technology, can use it to hack American citizens. But we don't know how exact those restraints are. And more to the point, there are no restraints on hacking people in America, including Americans, by ICE itself, by the Department of Homeland Security itself. And privacy law experts have been in a state of high alarm about this, partly because they point out that the Department of Homeland Security is often the U.S. government office that purchases ethically and legally questionable technology and is able to circumvent a lot of scrutiny by arguing that they have a law enforcement national security basis for using it. So you now have a perfect storm, Amy, of technology of this type that's really powerful and really easily abused in the hands of the U.S. government, again, under the Biden administration. The Biden administration has, in response to reporting on this just recently, paused that contract. They say they're reviewing it. But the thing is, right around the corner, the Trump administration is coming in. And we can talk about this, but obviously the Trump administration is bringing in a raft of officials and Trump himself who have made explicit threats against the groups that, again and again, in Western democracies, have been most vulnerable to this kind of espionage.
That's Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Ronan Farrow and Matthew O'Neill talking about their new documentary, Surveil, that airs tonight at 9 on HBO, is streaming at Max. We'll link to Ronan's New Yorker article, The Technology the Trump Administration Could Use to Hack Your Phone. We'll talk more about that with him tomorrow. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks so much for joining us.
The Museum of Lenox in Addington invites you to join them over the holidays celebrating Friday Night Lights on Friday, November 29th, December 6th, and December 13th. Stop by the museum between 5 to 8 p.m. each night for a free visit, live music, open galleries, festive crafts with local artists in the Creation Corner, shopping in the museum gift shop, and a special museum kids holiday shop where kids can shop for $2 gifts and have their presents wrapped. Plus, attendees can also enjoy an immersive seasonal candlelit play, House Guest, created by and starring Kingston-based emerging actors and dance school of drama and music university students. Advance tickets are $10. Details at countymuseum.ca.
Hello, Kingston. This is Torkoal from Stars. You are listening to CFRC.